Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Okay, let's start the show with a statement from the American Heart Association regarding Juul's executive leadership change. This from the American Heart Association CEO Nancy Brown. She issued the following statement today in response to reports that a longtime Altria executive will become Juul's new chief executive. By appointing a longtime Altria executive as its new CEO, Juul is fully embracing its identity as a tobacco company that prioritizes profits over public health. We are deeply concerned that under the leadership of someone who was most recently responsible for growing the market for Marlboro and other deadly tobacco products, Juul will continue to prey upon youth and mislead the public about the health risks of e-cigarette use. No one should mistake the company's suspension of its marketing efforts as anything other than a naked attempt to ease public pressure and curry favor with elected officials. The company's track record of lies and deceit, which has resulted in more than 5 million youth e-cigarette users at risk for nicotine addiction, is unfortunately the best predictor of the company's future behavior. Neither Juul nor any other tobacco company can be trusted to act on its own in the best interests of our nation's youth. We urge the Trump administration to move forward with its plans to immediately remove all flavored e-cigarettes from the market. I'm particularly impressed by this statement, which is very strong and to the point, because the American Heart Association is really a pretty mainstream organization. So I was delighted to see that they were coming out and not holding any punches. While the CDC sorts out the causes of the growing lung illnesses and deaths that are related to e-cigarette use, we really can't be distracted from using addiction as a business model and cynically targeting vulnerable populations such as youth. Nicotine is not a safe substance to be used, particularly by youth when their brain is still growing and developing. You don't need to layer addiction on top of adolescent and young adult brain development. Okay, well now on to the public health news and research roundup, where I gather up all the great stuff in the wonderful world of public health so you don't have to.
Attention listeners, as per the WAKT Pro Bono Legal Department, please note that this public health news and research roundup has no affiliation with the herbicide Roundup, which is a registered trademark of Monsanto. Also, please note that, unlike the herbicide Roundup, this public health news and research Roundup is not a known human carcinogen.
Okay, first up, from the Center for Health Journalism, how active shooter drills in schools are traumatizing our children. As our nation's children return to school, they will be greeted with the usual staples of education in America: new classes and teachers, the latest and trendiest technology, and school supplies, followed shortly by relentless test-taking. It is probable they will also be met with more recent school staples: active shooter drills and armed guards or police monitoring their hallways. The first few back-to-school staples are benign, but the newer practices are a real problem. For our children, going to school has never been so terrifying. Not because they are likely to encounter an active shooter — the vast majority won't — but because for several years now, we have drilled the terrifying possibility into their impressionable bones. We tell kindergartners to hush while they hide under their desks or in closets. We teach them songs to sing and games to play so they'll remember how to hide and stay quiet if a shooter is in their school. We teach them how to scatter, running in different directions away from the gunman, a game known as popcorn in some schools. We direct elementary school children, as a last result if they hear a gunman about to enter the room, to fight back, pelting him with books, erasers, or anything handy. And we show them how to balance while standing on the toilet so the shooter won't be able to see their tiny feet. It's true that gun violence is at epidemic proportions in America, but while the deadliest and most horrific public shootings break our hearts and stoke our outrage, the truth is that we are preparing children for an event that more than 99% will never experience, while creating a source of potential trauma for 100% of children trembling under their desks. I'd also like to address, I don't actually think this was stated strongly enough, this is not anywhere near close to only 99% never experiencing this. It's probably closer to 1 in a million. So I thought they were being a little conservative in striking just a mere 99% will never experience this. Okay, on with the article. Our collective response is so out of proportion to the risk that predictably there is an entire industry around school shootings, such as the for-profit businesses supplying bulletproof backpacks to terrified parents and private security companies specializing in must-have school shooting expertise, arming guards, and policing the students. Teachers are not immune from the terror either. Earlier this year, an active shooter drill in Indiana garnered national attention after a mock gunman shot teachers with rubber pellets, executing them one at a time. What are we doing to our children, parents, and teachers? This is what. In the name of our deepest fears, we are traumatizing a whole generation, drilling them again and again to imagine terrifying scenarios at school. I don't blame schools or parents for trying everything they can imagine to keep children safe. Congress has not taken the necessary measures to pass strong policies, and after each mass shooting, calls for change are loud, but nothing has changed. This leaves communities to their own devices, but it is time to question whether such continuous shooter drills are worth the trauma we are inflicting on a generation of children. While many school administrators are stepping up their realistic shooting drills, they are also subjecting kids to trauma and the increased fortification of their schools. More guards, more armed guards, dramatized shootings replete with fake blood and student actors' bodies on the hallway floors. Black and Latino children are struggling to shake free of the over-policing that has now followed them from the streets into the classroom. Moreover, school policing efforts have not necessarily made our nation's schools safer. According to the National Institute for Education Statistics, 20 years ago, about 10% of public schools employed at least one police officer. By 2014, 42% did. As rare as school shootings are, there has been no significant deterrence of crime or decrease in school shootings. Remember, guards at Columbine and Marjory Stoneham Douglas were armed. Instead, there has been an increase in the number of students of color who wind up being stunned with tasers in the classroom and arrested for youthful infractions such as fistfights and vandalism, infractions that were once met with a trip to the principal's office, a call home, or suspension. Police officers on school campuses can legally use physical force on students, handcuff them, and have them arrested for simply misbehaving. Far from creating a safe environment to learn, such policing fuels the school-to-prison pipeline, the entry point to the criminal justice system for too many black and brown kids, and contributes to mass incarceration. We cannot forget the trauma caused by this unnecessary force, witnessed by other students, and the long-term effect it has on the psyche of the students. Nothing resists facts like fear, but here goes. Schools are among the least likely places in our society for gun violence. Most deaths by firearms are suicides, then community shootings and interpersonal violence, then unintentional shootings. Last is what preoccupies us most, mass shootings in public spaces, and specifically schools. It's up to each school to figure out what's best for their students, but parents and school administrators must look at the data and square that with their own fears of school shootings. Just as schools should not be forced to abandon the drills, neither should they be required to have them. And let's remember that when making district-wide policies, what might be under consideration for suburban schools can be harmful for our urban schools. The hardening of our schools and therein our children is not benign. Active shooter drills have consequences, and so does the influx of school resource officers, especially in urban schools. So let's be honest about what we're doing. We aren't saving or protecting most kids, but we are certainly traumatizing many and downright victimizing others. Okay, on a somewhat related note regarding gun violence, this from The Hill, the Surgeon General's deafening silence on gun violence. Recently, the head of the Association of American Medical Colleges called gun violence a public health crisis in America, saying those of us in the healthcare field have a central role to play. This voice adds to the increasing chorus of leading medical organizations, including the American Medical Association, American Public Health Association, American Academy of Family Physicians, and the American College of Surgeons, demanding action on the issue. Yet, there is one high-profile figure conspicuously absent from this growing symphony of doctors calling for change, the Surgeon General of the United States. On matters of national public health, we should be able to rely on America's highest medical authority for guidance, but the individual who occupies that office today, Dr. Jerome Adams, has done nothing to lead our country forward on this issue, which claimed an estimated 40,000 lives last year alone. Gun violence is nowhere to be found in any of Dr. Adams' lists of top priorities. He's offered no proactive plan to confront it, and he was notably silent in the aftermath of the Dayton, Ohio, and El Paso, Texas mass shootings that claimed the lives of 31 people over a single weekend last month. When asked directly if gun violence is a public health threat in America, he refused to give a yes or no answer. He sidestepped it, saying that it, quote, depends by definition on the community that we're talking about. Four of Dr. Adams' past predecessors, including one Republican, have urged the Centers for Disease Control to continue researching gun violence research. That's because the CDC has been effectively blocked from studying the issue and examining ways to prevent it due to an arcane law known as the Dickey Amendment. Dr. Adams has made no attempt to join his former colleagues in calling for more federal dollars to better understand the root causes for gun violence's rise in America and what measures we must collectively take to try and stop it. Why has he remained silent? Acknowledging gun violence is an unqualified public health crisis that would likely put him in disfavor with the Trump administration. Dr. Adams's predecessor, Dr. Vivek Murthy, nominated by President Obama to be the 19th Surgeon General of the U.S., made that declaration, and it nearly derailed his confirmation before the GOP-controlled U.S. Senate. Dr. Murthy's position didn't conform with President Trump's view on guns, and Trump removed him from office before his four-year term had completed. And so on it goes. The violence continues with no interest or involvement from America's top doctor. Dr. Adams could lead by example and develop a plan to confront the gun epidemic in our country. He could make a proactive statement about prevention or acknowledge the toll it is taking on American families and communities. Instead, he has turned a blind eye to a public health emergency his own contemporaries argue must be dealt with immediately. Americans must question whether Dr. Adams has put political expediency above the needs of a nation desperate for action on an issue that claims tens of thousands of lives each year. Dr. Adams is a voice for all Americans, especially the innocent victims of gun violence. His ear-splitting silence on the subject is incompatible with his oath as a physician and unbecoming of his duties as Surgeon General of the United States. Okay, sticking with the Center for Health Journalism, another story, investigative journalists reveal startling flaws in generic drug industry with FDA missing in action. Are generic medications interchangeable with one another and with brand name drugs? If you think they are, Catherine Eben's Bottle of Lies might cause you to reconsider. Eben, an investigative journalist, has spent more than a decade reporting on the state of generic drug manufacturing, particularly in India, working closely with whistleblowers, industry insiders, academic experts, and regulators. She explores the deceptive practices of generic drug firms that produce most of the medications our patients use every day. Eben describes the remarkable reach of international generic drug manufacturers. 80% of the active ingredients in all our drugs, whether brand or generic, come from overseas, the majority in India and China. 40% of the generic drugs, finished doses that we use in this country, come from India alone. 90% of our drug supply is generic, so the numbers are huge. Those of us who were taught that generic drugs are interchangeable with brand name medications because the FDA requires bioequivalency testing are in for a surprise. Not only does EBAN document case after case of unethical practices at large firms producing generics for the global market, but even more surprisingly, she exposes the frequent lack of action at the FDA when those practices are uncovered by their own investigators. In Eben's account, many top officials at the FDA appear more concerned with approving inexpensive drugs than protecting the public's health. They are also slow to question powerful companies and their prestigious law firms, with the latter serving as attractive future employers for agency officials. These themes of regulatory capture will not come as a surprise to those who have closely followed the agency's dereliction of duty on supplement regulation. Eben's investigation suggests that the lack of FDA enforcement permits an environment of fraud and lies to persist in many firms supplying generics to the global market. The ability of the U.S. to fund inexpensive treatment, for example, to treat HIV in Africa, initially led generic manufacturing firms to outbid one another to provide medications for lower and lower prices. A medication that costs $8,000 or more a year in the U.S. was produced for $2 a day or less. These bargains were too good to pass up or even to question. But ensuring those low prices often led to corner cutting, and the result was inconsistent quantities of active agents from batch to batch and poor design of capsules, a threat to patient safety and lives. Eben argues that this is not just a problem in the developing world, and that patients in the U.S. today continue to be exposed to risk when they receive inadequate dosages of pharmaceuticals from poorly produced generic medications. After a bottle of lies, we'll be adding another diagnosis when a patient with a previously well-controlled chronic disease loses ground. As before, we'll consider the possibility that the problem may be due to the natural history of the disease, a new environmental exposure, a change in diet, or lack of compliance. But now, we'll also need to consider the possibility that it could have been triggered by unscrupulous manufacturing practices of an essential medication. In such cases, the best step may not be changing the medication or adjusting the dose, but changing the manufacturer, at least until the FDA proves to patients and physicians that it's up to the task of properly regulating the generics industry. Okay, and sticking with the healthcare theme here, this from the World Health Organization. Millions of patients are harmed each year due to unsafe healthcare worldwide, resulting in 2.6 million deaths annually in low and middle income countries alone. Most of these deaths are avoidable. The personal, social, and economic impact of patient harm leads to losses of trillions of U.S. dollars worldwide. No one should be harmed while receiving health care, and yet globally, at least five patients die every minute because of unsafe care, said Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, the WHO Director General. We need a patient safety culture that promotes partnership with patients, encourages reporting and learning from errors, and creates a blame-free environment where health workers are empowered and trained to reduce errors. 4 out of every 10 patients are harmed during primary and ambulatory health care. The most detrimental errors are related to diagnosis, prescription, and use of medicines, and the use of medicines. Medication errors alone cost an estimated $42 billion annually. Unsafe surgical care procedures cause complications in up to 25% of patients, resulting in 1 million deaths during or immediately after surgery every year. Patient harm in healthcare is unacceptable. The World Health Organization is calling for urgent action by countries and partners around the world to reduce patient harm in healthcare. Patient safety and quality of care are essential for delivering effective healthcare services and achieving universal health coverage. Investment in improving patient safety can lead to significant financial savings. The cost of prevention is much lower than the cost of treatment due to harm. As an example, in the United States alone, focused safety improvements led to an estimated $28 billion in savings in Medicare hospitals between 2010 and 2015. Okay, once again, prevention, well worth it, even in healthcare. Okay, this from Stat News. With ominous TV spots and a senior strike force, AARP launches an all-out attack on pharma. AARP has partnered with United Healthcare to sell private Medicare plans since 1998, and the royalties from those plans and other AARP-branded products have rapidly become more and more important to the group's bottom lines. Royalties from sales of all AARP-branded products increased by more than $600 million since 2002, and now make up more than 55% of AARP's annual revenue, according to the group's 2017 financial disclosures, the latest year publicly available. It's tough to break out exactly how much the group made from its insurance plans alone, but its 2017 disclosures suggest it brought in $627 million that year. The insurance business, indeed, all the organization's branded products and services, are run through AARP Services, Inc., which the organization describes as a wholly owned taxable subsidiary. It focuses on quality control and oversight for any products that bear the AARP name or logo. Despite that separation, some say the business relationship creates an insurmountable conflict of interest. The group has gotten heat from liberal groups. Public Citizen released its own report in 2014 claiming AARP did not support single-payer health care because its benefits from the current system of private insurance. So I only read part of that article. Of course, the title is this about these ominous TV spots, you know, where AARP is launching an all-out attack on pharma, and like, who could be against that? But I found this section that I just read the most fascinating inside, talking about their own conflict of interest when it comes to healthcare and even pharmacy. This is one of the reasons why we really need to have universal healthcare to clean up a lot of these perverse incentives that are driven by private health insurance, including AARP's.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, from Science Daily. Stressed out? Americans making themselves sick over politics. Never-ending campaigns, social media, 24-hour news cycles, politics are impossible to escape even for the casual observer. But are policy fights and polarization more than a headache in the collective consciousness? New research from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln suggests yes, that we are making ourselves sick over politics. Nearly 40% of Americans surveyed for the study said politics is stressing them out, and one in five are losing sleep. These responses and others show many in the United States believe their mental and physical health has been harmed in some way by exposure to politics. 20% have damaged friendships because of political disagreements. One in five report fatigue, and it's a small proportion, but 4% of the people in our sample say they have suicidal thoughts because of politics. That translates into 10 million adults. Among other findings, 11.5% reported politics had adversely affected their physical health. 31.8% said exposure to media outlets promoting views contrary to personal beliefs had driven them crazy. 29.3% said they've lost their temper as a result of politics. One in five say differences in political views have damaged a friendship. 22.1% admit they care too much about who wins and who loses. Politics is really negatively affecting a lot of people's lives, or at least they're perceiving that politics is really negatively affecting their lives in deep and meaningful ways. Stress is a real phenomenon that can have disastrous health effects. If politics is a significant contributor to the levels of stress that American adults are experiencing, then yeah, it makes sense that there's a real add-on health effect from that. Perceptions of political stress emerge more in respondents who consider themselves on the left side of the political spectrum. This may be tied to the controversial 2016 election cycle. Yes, right-wing government will do that to you. Okay, well, hopefully here at Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, Ohio, we act radio, and we can bring more solutions than problems. That's my hope today. Okay, well, let's go back and look at a really interesting story. This also from Science Daily. Heart-healthy forager farmers in lowland Bolivia are changing diets and gaining weight. A group of forager farmers in Bolivia's tropical forests, known for having remarkable cardiovascular health and low blood pressure, experienced changes in body mass and diet over a 9-year period with increased use of cooking oil, the most notable dietary change. The Tisamine people, a pre-industrial society, traditionally hunt, fish, farm, and gather food for their subsistence, said Baylor University anthropologist Alan Schultz, Ph.D., MPH, co-author of a study published in the journal Obesity. Their diet, traditionally higher in carbohydrates, fiber, and protein, and lower in fat than the average United States diet, includes plantains, rice, manioc, maize, and fruit, as well as lean game, freshwater fish, and occasional honey. But recent population growth, along with encroachment on their territory, has put pressure on supplies of game and fish, while more opportunities to attend school and earn wages correspond with reductions in traditional cultural knowledge and lifestyle practices. With these changes have come greater access to and reliance on market foods, such as refined grains, refined sugar, cooking oil, and domestic foods like pigs, chickens, and eggs, according to the study conducted from 2002 to 2010. Researchers who conducted a 2017 study funded by the NIH National Institute on Aging reported that the Tisamine had better cardiovascular health than ever has been measured in any other population. And unfortunately, it's been going down as they're being, quote, modernized. And this has been mostly associated with increased use of cooking oil. That was most associated with body mass index or excess weight. While consumption of domesticated animal products was positively associated with female obesity and male waist circumference. While sugar intake increased by about 13% annually, neither it nor refined grains had detectable associations with changes in body fat. So we take a pre-industrial society and we move them up into the modern world, and unfortunately that worsens their health. Okay, back to the Center for Health Journalism. This story or commentary, are schools putting the brakes on making meals healthier for kids? If you knew a good way to save the lives of children in school, we would do it, right? Remember the story about gun violence? We read about school shootings and feel helpless or angry. When we read about how many children are overweight and obese in the United States, though, we don't react the same way. And yet, reducing illness and death related to poor diets would save more lives in the U.S. than even a total ban on gun sales. One of the ways we, as a society, have collectively moved towards healthier eating for kids is by agreeing, with the exception of food industry lobbyists, on what kids should be served in school meals. There have been two major pieces of legislation that have nudged schools in the right direction: the 1966 Child Nutrition Act and the 2010 Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act. Both pieces of legislation were fought over and flawed, and multiple scientific papers have been written about their creation, implementation, and impact. What we do know for certain is that over time, these two laws have led to healthier foods being offered at schools and to kids eating more fruits, vegetables, and other healthier foods. At the same time, laws often have loopholes. As with other organizations with multiple constituencies to please and budgets to balance, some school districts have been leaders for pushing for healthy foods and others have been laggards. The Healthy and Hunger-Free Kids Act set a fairly high bar for what schools should try to achieve in improving the intake of healthy foods. Two key areas codified in the legislation are also two of the areas of diet that have the biggest impact on health. One, whole grains. Diets low in whole grains were recently cited in a study published in The Lancet as the top driver of diet-related health loss, robbing people of 85 million years of healthy life through chronic diseases and premature death. Two, the same study found that diets high in sodium were the second biggest risk factor for poor health. Worldwide, diets high in sodium were tied to more than 70 million lost years of healthy life. Despite the evidence, parts of the food industry have fought the food standards from the beginning and continue to fight it. Also, some districts have complained that they could not meet the new standards as cost-effectively as they could the earlier, less healthy rules. Others complained that kids were tossing the healthier fare in trash cans. So, gradually, the tough rules had become softer, including the decision in 2017 by the agency that oversees school food policy to allow districts to bypass the rules on whole grains and sodium. 90% of American kids eat too much sodium every day. Schools have been moving in the right direction, so it makes no sense to freeze that progress in its tracks and allow dangerously high levels of salt in school lunch. Also, I would note that well over 90% of Americans, including young adults and children, don't get the recommended intake of whole grains. That's national recommendations to get at least half of the grains that you eat eaten as whole grains. Okay, another really kind of interesting story from a scientific and health perspective. This one on the cutting edge of microplastics. Some tea bags may shed billions of microplastics per cup. Many fancier teas are now in silken bags instead of paper, and some of them are pyramid-shaped, which is billed as a way to make room for the large leaves and premium teas to expand. You may be swallowing billions of tiny plastic particles while sipping a cup of freshly brewed gourmet tea, a new study from McGill University in Montreal suggests. Many fancier teas now come in silken bags instead of paper. Some of them are pyramid-shaped, which is billed as a way to make room for the large leaves and premium teas to expand. Natalie Tafunchi, a professor of chemical engineering at the Montreal University, was surprised to find one such bag in the tea she ordered from a coffee shop one morning. "It looks like plastic," she recalled. I said, "Oh God, I'm sure if it's plastic, it's like breaking down into the tea." So when she got into the lab, she asked her graduate student, Laura Hernandez, to go out and buy a bunch from different brands. The plastics are made of polyethylene terephthalate, found in plastic drink bottles, and nylon, used in many food bags and pouches, that are approved as food packaging. Sure enough, Hernandez's lab test showed that when steeped in hot water, the tea bags release microplastic and even smaller nanoplastic particles, and not just the hundreds or thousands Tufenkji had been expecting. "We were shocked when we saw billions of particles in a single cup of tea," she said. "One cup from a single tea bag contained 11.6 billion microplastic and 3.1 billion nanoplastic particles. The bits are so tiny, on average the size of grains of dust or pollen, that the amount in one cup is about 16 micrograms or 1/60th of a milligram of plastic. But there's still much more that needs to be, that has been found in other foods and beverages, including tap and bottled water, beer, honey, fish and shellfish, chicken, and salt." Tufekci said that partly because her study included encounter smaller particles than most other studies, but it's also because for most foods and beverages, the plastic is an accidental contaminant. With tea, you're literally adding plastic into the beverage. That may sound unappetizing, but is it a health risk? In general, there isn't much known on the impact of microplastics on human health. Tufenkji says the potential health risk isn't the only reason to stick to paper tea bags and loose leaf tea. "Personally, I would say to avoid the plastic tea bags because it's just another single-use plastic, something many governments are trying to reduce due to the impact on oceans and the challenges of recycling it." Matthew Hoffman, a researcher who studies freshwater plastic pollution at the Rochester Institute of Technology, but wasn't involved in the new study, said the experiment seemed well-designed and robust. "One of the big takeaways is that the humans would be exposed to orders of magnitude more plastic particles than has been reported from previous food and drink studies." His colleague, Christy Tyler, an aquatic ecologist who was also not involved in the newly released research, noted the small size of the particles in the study. "We're getting a clear understanding that nanoscale plastics, like other nanoscale particles, can cross into cells. It's cause for caution in how we approach widespread use of these materials in our everyday products." Okay, and sticking with the plastic themes, let's end with what might be some good news. This from Newsweek. SC Johnson joins Coca-Cola and PepsiCo in ditching ties to Plastic Industry Association. This trend will only continue. SC Johnson & Son Incorporated is the latest major company to announce it will cut ties with the Plastics Industry Association lobbying group following pressure from activists. The company, which owns household brands such as Glade, Pledge, Windex, and Raid, told Greenpeace USA that they will be allowing their membership with the group to lapse following disagreements with some of their policies. The Plastics Industry Association has previously lobbied for states to prohibit banning plastic bags and to speak out against imposing stricter restrictions on plastic use across the country. Earlier this year, Coca-Cola and PepsiCo both announced that they would be cutting ties with the Plastic Industry Association over fears membership would contradict their goals to drastically reduce single-use plastics. The soft drink giants are hoping that 100% of their packaging will be made from recyclable, compostable, or biodegradable materials by 2025. This should be a wake-up call for the plastics industry, Greenback USA Oceans Campaign Director John Hoxavar said. SC Johnson, Coca-Cola, and PepsiCo have all recognized that standing alongside a group working to strip away the rights of communities to reduce our reliance on dangerous plastics is not good for business. This trend will only continue as more companies move away from plastics and towards systems of refill and reuse. It's time for industry to stop fighting people who are working for solutions and either get on board or get out of the way. Well, that does it for our show today. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com, T-O-P-P-U-N.com. Or if you'd like to listen to this show or any earlier shows, you can go anytime to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible. But in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.